Here we are then. All serious and dedicated, looking for enlightenment. They call awakening. Hoping that it's all true. They're hoping that there really was a Buddha and he really taught the way to enlightenment. And that he made it possible for others to realize it as well. And sometimes it's a long and lonely path. Sometimes it's not obvious where we should be going, which way we should be turning. And yet there's something that many things that provide nourishment and sustenance along the way. One of the things which helps to show us and to give us faith that this path really is possible is this quality which the Buddha mentioned. There's one similarly the Buddha said, like two great rivers, the Ganges and the Yamuna, and they flow together and merge and meld together. In the same way the path melds and culminates in Nibbana. So there's this idea of the unity or the not necessarily unity, but the like a shared essence, a shared quality to the practices that we do and to the goal that those practices are meant to lead us to. And one of the expressions of this shared quality is the group of dhammas that we call the bodhangas, awakening factors or enlightenment factors. And these express that quality in quite a curious way. Because the name in awakening factors is itself a little bit ambiguous and does it mean the factors of awakening, does it mean those things or those qualities which are characteristic of the experience of awakening, or does it mean those factors which lead towards awakening? In the Pali Abhidhamma tradition, they tended to interpret it in the first way, mainly treats the awakening factors as being the qualities of the mind at the time of the penetration through to the Dhamma. But in the suttas, the awakening factors are understood in the second way, and that is as those things which lead towards awakening. And of course this ambiguity is actually quite nice. It reminds us that the goal of awakening is not something which is separate and distinct from the path to it. On the contrary, that in developing the path, we're developing those same qualities which when they're ripened, matured, perfected, fulfilled, will characterize the nature of the enlightened mind itself. So the awakening factors are sati, mindfulness, dhamma vijaya, investigation of dhammas, virya, energy, piti, rapture, basadhi, tranquility, samadhi, means samadhi, and upekkha, equanimity. So seven factors, seven familiar dhammas, qualities to be developed, seven things which can be easily understood and compared with the presentations of the dhammas in various contexts, and shares a lot in common obviously with things like the Eightfold Path and the Five Spiritual Faculties and so on, and yet has, as always, its own particular nuance and its particular emphasis. And each of these different presentations of Dhamma is really just illuminating the same thing from a slightly different perspective. So in this particular group, because it starts with sati, mindfulness, and then dhamma vijaya, so in a sense it's kind of skipped over, if you like, or not mentioned the sila parts of the path. So sila is not mentioned in this particular teaching, but it starts with the more directly internal and contemplative part of the path. Now these first two factors, sati and dhamma vicaya, can be understood in two ways and are actually explained in the context of the Bodhjhangas in both of these ways. And the first way is on a more straightforward level, or more mundane level, that one hears the teachings, just like we're all sitting here listening to the teachings now, and then afterwards you remember and recollect those teachings. This is the sati sambodhjhanga, memory. And then remembering and recollecting it, you investigate those teachings, dhamma vijaya. So here we're operating at a conventional level, a conceptual level, that process of scrutiny and understanding of the actual teachings, the concepts of the Dhamma as taught by the Buddha, that process. I think it's interesting that that this process of how understanding is expressed so simply and yet so precisely, as a way of learning something. And I can't remember, for example, in all my years of schooling, being told so clearly and straightforwardly and specifically that this is how you learn to understand something. When you're listening to a teaching, the first thing you have to do is remember it. The second thing you have to do is reflect on it and contemplate it and try to understand it. And one of the things that this reminds us is that our engagement with the teachings should be an active one. It's not just a passive absorbing of the truth that kind of manifests, but it's an active process, active listening, actively bringing it to mind again after you've heard the teaching, reminding yourself of what that is. Yeah? And so you could do that after the teaching's finished, after a Dhamma talk or something like that. Don't distract yourself by getting into conversations and all of these kinds of things. As soon as the teaching's finished, you should go back to your kuti, back to your hut. As you're walking back, recollect what the teaching was about. remind yourself what were the important points. Keep on going over them and over them. And as you're doing so, then that gives you a chance to go into that sort of deeper aspect of the Dhamma Vichaya. And the Dhamma Vichaya is more like synthesizing your understanding of the teachings. It's consolidating it. Recognizing the relationship and connection between different parts of the teaching. Clarifying the parts that are understood or the parts that you still have doubts or questions about. Developing deeper levels of insight into particular aspects of it. So this is instructions for what we should do during the Dhamma talk, paying clear attention, actively listening, and then after the Dhamma talk, bringing it back to mind again and again and again, and investigating the meaning of those things again and again and again. That's how you get real benefit out of it. So this is one meaning of this first pair of dhammas. The second meaning of this first pair of dhammas is sati in more of its contemplative sense, in terms of mindfulness or satipatthana. And in this way, sati essentially means paying attention to your meditation object. Bearing the meditation object in mind. Okay, so it's equivalent in terms of its meaning and in terms of its function within the path. It's equivalent to the yogic term dharana, which is just a synonym for sati that they use in the yogic Ashtanga Magga. And the dharana literally means bearing something in mind, holding something in mind. It's also a term for memory, just as sati is. So bearing your meditation object in mind, reminding oneself of the meditation, recollecting oneself with the meditation, remembering again and again and again. This is your practice of mindfulness in the meditation, holding the breath in mind, keeping it in mind again and again and again. That continuity of awareness that comes through remembering what you're supposed to be doing. So think about this. Think about when you're doing tasks. So for example, if you're doing a task at chores time, what happens if you are asked to do a particular chore? After an hour or so, you forget what you're supposed to be doing and you get distracted. You start getting into a conversation or drift off and do some other kind of work or something like that. What's happened there? Well, you've forgotten what you're doing. And so you do a bit of one thing and a bit of another thing, and at the end of the day, you haven't really done anything. That's called the lack of mindfulness. The mindfulness that works in meditation, you remember what you're doing. Oh, I'm here to watch the breath. I remember that breath. I remember the practice of metta. I remember the contemplation of impermanence. I remember the contemplation of the parts of the body. I remember the recollection of Buddha. I remember whatever meditation I'm doing, I remember that. And I keep on applying myself back to that meditation again and again and again. Now in that context, Dhamma Vichaya in this context has a different meaning than the contemplation of the meaning of teachings, but has a meaning which is basically the same as Dhamma Anupassana, or contemplation of Dhammas in Satipatthana. And so that means essentially contemplation of the way the mind is working, and particularly cause and effect. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is that as we meditate, our mind changes, the breath changes, the meditation object changes. It becomes more subtle, becomes more peaceful, more stable. The qualities of the mind change. Different emotions come and go. The mind moves in different ways. Dhamma Vicaya is the one that reflects on that and investigates it and understands why it changes in this way and why it doesn't. And in particular, the purpose of Dhamma Vicaya is to understand the relationship between the seven bodhihangas, the awakening factors, and the five nivarana, the five hindrances. Or sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt, the five hindrances. Now that the five hindrances are said to be the opposite of the seven awakening factors in many places. It's a very common teaching, a very standard teaching. And so in the mind at any one time, there'll be like a balance or a dynamic as these two kind of forces working there. You can feel the presence of these things in the mind. The nivaranas, the hindrances leading towards darkness, towards confusion, towards ignorance, towards suffering. The awakening factors leading towards life, towards peace, towards wisdom, towards liberation. And so as our meditation goes, we can reflect on these things and understand why that particular ones may be arising or dissipating at one particular time or another. And in some cases, we may see a general relationship between them. So for example, if you're doing a lot of meditation, for example, spending a lot of time developing the awakening factors in your meditation, then at that time, generally speaking, the hindrances tend to be very low. And so there's a kind of a general relationship between them as well. But there also may be a particular relationship between particular factors at certain times. That may change from time to time. There's various lists of these kinds of things which you can look in places like the Visuddhimagga and so on, and it gives you a hint. But of course, in the complexity of human mind, these things are always changeable. They're not hard and fast things by any means, but there's certainly something to those. So for example, if you're finding that there's a lot of ill will in the mind, then you may find that that's because there's a lack of joy, a lack of piti or rapture. And then when the mind has a lot of joy, it feels very happy, then it doesn't tend to get so much ill will or so much anger there. Another example, if there's a lot of doubting in the mind, then that may be because there's a lack of clear investigation and understanding of the teachings. So you have doubts because there's many questions that you have that are unanswered, and so you need to make efforts to answer those questions, to ask about them and clear up your doubts, to read books that will tend to explain the things that you need to have explained, and so on. And these can help to overcome your doubts. So in certain cases we can find specific correlations between the hindrances and the awakening factors. In other cases it may be just a general relationship between them. And so it's the purpose of your Dhamma Vicaya to investigate this and to understand. Now, what's that going to tell you? Well, sometimes it may simply tell you or remind you something simple. It may simply say, well, look, you know, you noticed that, you know, last week, you know, you're more determined in your meditation. You managed to do a good 5 or 6 hours a day in meditation. And you know, you felt really good. You felt very happy. And mind was clear and so on. This week, you got distracted and got involved in a few things that may be a bit of a waste of time, and a few kind of unnecessary projects, and a few sitting around chatting too long and so on, and you haven't done so much meditation, and you notice the mind is falling back and not being so bright and clear as it was. And so then that reminds you to you know, get your dedication back into it, get your focus back into the practice. In other cases, so you know, that may be a general thing. In other cases, that your Dhamma Vichaya might tell you something more specific. It might show you, oh, actually, you know, your sense of sloth and torpor, your kind of a lethargy and drowsiness, you know, tends to come up in specific cases. For example, if you're feeling down and depressed, then you don't really feel like meditating, and you tend to just want to sleep a lot. So, you know, that's something you need to look at and need to try to work at, try to overcome. So this is the role of Dhamma Vichaya as the wisdom factor. So remember, this is the wisdom factor in the context of developing the awakening factors. Okay, it's not the wisdom factor necessarily in terms of developing vipassana meditation as such. Okay, so it can be used in that way, but that's not really what it's talking about. So when I say developing vipassana meditation as such, what I mean is developing investigation into the five aggregates, into the six senses, dependent origination, and so on. So when we take these as our frameworks for meditation, then we're doing, you know, the centre of the meditation is then what we call vipassana, is investigation into impermanent suffering and not self. So Dhamma Vichaya here in the Bhojangas, it has a similar quality in terms of being an inquiry and an investigation into cause and effect and so on, but it's into that cause and effect within the context of that meditation and development of the awakening factors themselves. Right. So one question is, why are these factors, mindfulness and Dhamma Vichaya, why are they included at the beginning of these awakening factors? Where it's especially Dhamma Vichaya as the wisdom component, very often in the path the wisdom component is mentioned at the end and not at the beginning. So there must be some significance as to why the wisdom component is mentioned at the beginning. And the answer to that little question is this. When we look at the different ways that the path's presented, and this is most clear in the case of the Eightfold Path, it starts out with right view, samadhi. Of course, right view means investigating the teachings, considering them, and correcting one's ideas and concepts about the teaching. That's what right view essentially means. Now, if we go through the whole of the Eightfold Path, develop all of the other factors, then it ripens in the ninth factor of the Eightfold Path, right knowledge, samanyana. Of course, the ninth factor of the Eightfold Path is the, sometimes they have the Tenfold Path as well, so samanyana. And so samanyana, right knowledge or right insight, is what happens when you have the right view, develop all the other factors, and then that culminates into that direct insight into things. So the samadhi is the early factor, is the more conceptual, preliminary knowledge, and the samanyana is the deep insight. So when we look into the Bhojangas, you can see that when Dhamma Vichaya and Sati is presented as investigation and memory of the teachings and reflection on them, then that's very similar to the path factor of right view. That's at the preliminary conceptual side. And so this is why those factors are there at the beginning. And whenever the sequence of these awakening factors is stressed, okay, so in those contexts that it talks about how these things arise one after the other in the suttas, then it always, in those contexts, defines these as memory of the teaching and investigation and reflection on the teaching. Okay. Doesn't define them in the more contemplative sense. So this is why those factors are at the beginning, you know, the beginning when they're meant in that sense, that more preliminary sense of reflection on the teachings. So when you do that, then what happens? Well, according to the Bodhjangas and teaching of the Bodhjangas, energy is aroused. And that's a very important point. When you sort of put it in contrast or compare it to a situation where we, for example, we never hear the teachings. Put it in a place where we simply have no encounter with Buddhism. We haven't heard of the Dhamma, we've never heard of meditation. Okay, now in such a context, of course, we would never have any energy for the path, any spiritual energy, no spiritual inspiration. And so when we hear the teachings, that arouses our interest. And even that much, even turning our ear towards the Dhamma and trying to pay attention, trying to listen, already we're putting forth effort. Already we're trying. Already we're striving to understand. So that factor of energy is already coming into play right then. Then after the teaching, after you heard the teaching again, that energy is what enables us to recollect the Dhamma, put an effort into remembering the teaching. Not just treating it like some kind of trivial thing you can just let wash away. The Dhamma is much too important for that. It's much too precious. It's not just something you just hear and then just let it disappear into the sand. It has a depth and has a profundity. And you need to put effort to remind yourself of that, to investigate, to reflect on it. And put energy and effort into that. This is how your understanding will grow. And so when we put effort and energy into understanding and teachings, then this encourages us, reminds us, oh, we've got to go back and do our meditation. It reminds us what's really of value in the world. It reminds us of the futility of making excuses for ourselves. It reminds us that we only have one task here. Task to get awakened. This is the meaning of our lives. It's what we're here for. It's the highest and noblest task that any human being can aspire to. And it will not drop into our lap. It will not come when we're making excuses. It will not come when we're blaming others. It will not come when we're blaming our circumstances. It will not come when we're trying to explain away our own inadequacies. It will only come when we forget about all that stuff and actually do it. There is no substitute. Everything else is just dross, just a waste of mental energy. The more we have clarity around that, the more energy will be inspired in us. Don't waste our precious mental space on negativity and doubts and all of that stuff. Just focus on doing what's necessary, doing what needs to be done. And you know what that feels like, don't you? If we're lazy, if we give way to our negativity, if we give way to our defilements and give way to all that stuff, then our mind gets dull. It shrinks. Our perspectives get narrower. the more we put effort into our practice, the more we strive, then the more there's a sense of joy there. We feel happy when it feels good to put forth effort. Even though it might hurt, still it feels good. So that's how this energy goes or ripens into the factor of piti, of joy, rapture, uplift, excitement, thrill. Now, when it's when the rapture starts to arise, this is that's that moment, you cross over that moment when you're actually starting to get some feedback from your meditative process. You're starting to realize, oh, actually this is really working. And it's quite extraordinary. I remember the first times when this happened to me that I couldn't believe it, you know, because all of these things which I'd kind of read about or heard about vaguely, you know, kind of mystical experiences, to me that was always kind of very alien. I never thought of myself as being someone who that was applicable to. And then these things started happening, you know, you can feel that sense of uplift, you can feel the hairs rising up on your body, you can feel the kind of electric shock of energy going through your body. You can feel the body being filled with so much energy that it just vibrates where it is. All these different experiences, which are all part of the experience of rapture, piti. So piti is an emotional quality, an emotional response to the meditation. And so it's one of those qualities which is balancing out. We've already had the more sort of cognitive or intellectual processes under Dhamma Vichana, and so we're now balancing those out with the more emotive qualities. Something which you feel, something which is embodied. And so rapture is something that we should be seeking for, something we should be developing. And rapture happens when we let go of any negativity, any cynicism, any kind of sense of narrowness or doubting or something. And rapture is this very kind of naive, wholehearted kind of throwing oneself into the meditation. You get caught, it's when you get to that moment when you get caught up in the moment. Yeah? The rapture is like you know, go to a football match and you sit there and you're watching the game, and then suddenly someone kicks a spectacular goal, and then you find you're on your feet along with 50,000 people screaming. I've never done that, by the way. I can imagine what it would be like if I had any interest in football at all. But it's that moment when it crosses over and you realise, or maybe it's like, you know, you're watching a film and, you know, you're just kind of sitting there watching it and you don't quite realise that the film is sort of getting you emotionally involved in it, like you're doing your meditation and you don't quite realise how emotionally involved you're getting with your meditation. And then there comes that point when the hero dies or something like that, and then you cry, and then suddenly it all comes out and you're actually identifying with the emotions of the movie. The same way in the meditation, you develop that meditation for a while and it feels like it's something dry, it feels like something a bit external or artificial, but then there comes that point when you suddenly that emotion comes up within the meditation, and you realize, oh, that there's this emotional connection. It's like a devotion to your meditation, a faith in the meditation, like a heart opening and leaping forward towards the meditation. It's what I'm wanting to give to it. And this is that experience of rapture. The rapture, which any kind of rapture is good. Okay, so anytime you feel that kind of emotional breaking down and opening into the meditation, however that happens, then just let that go. Just go with it. Okay, you can't have too much of that. Just need to keep on encouraging that more and more and more. Remembering that piti is still a factor of the first two jhanas. So until you have mastered the second jhana, then you don't want to be letting go of the piti. But nevertheless, even though you won't want to be letting go of it, what you do want to be doing is maturing it, deepening it. And the deep form of piti or rapture is very pervasive, suffuses the whole body, so it's stable. This is what we're kind of aiming towards or moving towards. Don't be in a hurry with that. If you can have more sort of surging or gushing forms of piti or rapture, then it's okay. Just be with them as long as they want to be. It doesn't matter. Just keep on going with it. But eventually, you want to just gradually, maybe even months of practice or years of practice, and the piti is still sort of surging up or swelling up in very strong forms. Just keep on going, doesn't matter. But eventually you have to learn to make it more subtle, make it more tranquil, and move over to that aspect we call prasadhi, or tranquility. And that tranquility is actually very, very similar in meaning and in treatment in the suttas to sukha or bliss. Not quite the same, but they're very closely aligned. And so that rapture, which has a charged sense to it, it becomes balanced with this sense of tranquility. Okay, now in actual meditation practice, these two factors will balance themselves out in various ways. It's not always the case that rapture comes first and tranquility comes afterwards. They work together. Sometimes tranquility comes deep first. But be careful of that. Be careful of, especially in breath meditation, of taking the tranquility too deep for too long before allowing a rapture to arise. The mind will get bored. It will stay stuck on a fairly shallow level of samadhi and can easily drop into a state of unawareness, what they call bhavanga. And it's just like a kind of a dropping into a dreamless sort of semi-sleep state. Where it's very peaceful but not very aware. And rapture is the quality that stops that from happening. It awakens the mind, it develops interest in the mind. So if you're finding that you're doing meditation, especially doing breath meditation, if you're finding that the mind tends to fall asleep when you're doing it, then you need to develop the rapture more strongly. You can do that through doing metta or some other meditation that promotes development of rapture. Don't neglect that. Okay, this is something that I think a fallacy, which in modern meditation is very common, is this idea that you can develop meditation based on equanimity. And it's one of the hangovers from the emphasis on the Vipassana schools. You cannot develop any form of deep meditation based purely on equanimity, equanimous feeling. Even the Vipassana meditations and the very kind of low level of samadhi, or so-called samadhi, which they claim is sufficient for the Vipassana meditations, even those, according to the Visuddhimagga, require the development of rapture before even realizing Kanaka Samadhi or Upachara Samadhi. And that's quite in accordance with the suttas. So any attempt to develop insight based purely on equanimous feeling is effectively doomed. It's not developing the awakening factors which are the cause for insight to arise. So don't neglect this, and don't think that by practicing just equanimity with the breath or equanimity with one's investigation that that's sufficient to get you enough concentration to have deep insight. It's not. You need the attractive power of the bliss and the rapture to pull the mind in and glue the mind together, and then that will create that deeper sense of tranquility and stillness which will lead towards samadhi. So you can feel that tranquility, as pasaddhi, most obviously in breath meditation, where you actually first of all notice the tranquility of the breath. Breath shortening, becoming soft and silky and subtle. Eventually it can disappear altogether. You feel that in the body. You feel your body becoming at peace. With a kind of very hard to explain, a very deep leveled relaxation. Energy in the body is all settled. And becomes settled to a point where you almost become stuck in it. You almost become set in concrete. You can't move. It's just a perception, but it's just like a sign of deep tranquility. Yeah, and that sense of deep tranquility is also very healing for all kinds of disturbances, both bodily disturbances and mental disturbances as well. And just to have that space to be able to come into that space of rapture and tranquility gives us a refuge, an abiding place in our daytime. So then that tranquility, when that's matured and deepened, will lead to samadhi. And samadhi of course means the four dhyanas. Like all of these factors which are like leading or ripening on one from the other, then the four jhanas are something which matures out of development of all the earlier parts of the path, matures out of that sense of mindfulness. I think that's on the case, it's on the meditation and the energy that overcomes the hindrance of lethargy and drowsiness. The mind's very bright and clear. The rapture gives this sense of uplift and joy in the mind. Pasaddhi, the tranquility, is the stillness, the settledness of the mind. When all of those things come together, then the mind goes to what we call samadhi, one-pointedness of mind. So samadhi will only happen when you're not expecting it, you're not wanting it, you're not trying to get it. Mind withdraws, the five senses cease to operate. There's no sight, sound, smell, taste or touch. Mind is not thinking. Mind is not moving. You're aware of only the meditation object, absorbed into a sense of oneness with that rapture of light and joy. That's what we call the first jhana. And that state will last for a reasonable period of time. not something which you just pop in and out of, but will be settled down and last for a good period of time. Maybe an hour or two or something like that. For a fairly short one. Now, as the experience of samadhi deepens and settles, then one moves towards what we call the fourth jhana, and the fourth jhana, of course, characterized by upekkha, or equanimity. And notice how this equanimity always appears towards the end of any groups of dhammas. In the four Brahma viharas, equanimity is the last of the Brahma viharas. In the four jhanas, the fourth jhana is the equanimity jhana, and it's the last of them. In the bhojangas that we're talking about now, it's the last factor in the bhojangas. So equanimity is always the outcome of a very deep process of spiritual development. Again, reinforcing this point I made earlier, that you cannot develop deep meditation and deep insight based on equanimity from the beginning. Equanimity is an outcome. It doesn't mean to say we can't develop equanimity earlier. Of course we can. And of course it's part of our development at any stage of the path. I'm merely saying that you can't rely on equanimity alone without those other factors, awakening factors. So equanimity itself, the word basically means onlooking, or watching over something. So equanimity is not a kind of state of dullness or indifference. And again, this is one of those one of the reasons why it's an outcome of those practice. If we have very deep equanimity too early in our practice, then we tend to go to the side of dullness. Okay, so this is, the Buddha said that the counterpart of equanimity or neutral feeling is ignorance. Okay, so that's what that means, is that when our mind is too neutral, we get bored and lose interest. It doesn't have the clarity of awareness. But the counterpart of ignorance is knowledge. Okay? So equanimity is both the basis for ignorance, it's also the basis for knowledge. And it's the basis for ignorance when it's developed in the wrong way. And it's the basis for knowledge when it's developed in the context of the Eightfold Path as a whole, in the context of the awakening factors. And in that context, ignorance or equanimity has already been charged up with the energy, with the rapture, with all of the other factors. The mind's already charged with those things, and so then when it has the equanimity watching over, then it can maintain this sense of poise, a sense of alert contemplation, neither favouring nor opposing, just watching. And then it's from that poise which is the grounds or the basis for the deep penetration through to Dhamma. So typically within the context of the awakening factors as a whole, you started out with hearing the teachings, recollecting the teachings, investigating them, arousing of energy for practice, the joy that comes when we apply ourselves with energy and diligence to practice, the tranquility that joy brings us. The mind comes into oneness, into samadhi, into tranquility. And then as the outcome of that samadhi, the mind can watch, especially when you're withdrawn from a jhana or from experience of samadhi, mind's withdrawn and just watches. And then all of those other factors, they come to fruit, and especially the factor of investigation of dhammas, the wisdom factor, comes to fruit with this intuitive grasp or penetration of the truth. And at that point, when the truth begins to unveil itself, when the truth begins to open itself up to us bit by bit, that depth of equanimity allows us to watch that without shaking, without trembling. We have this mind moving towards it, grasping it, attaching to it, or stepping back from it, fearful, timid, cowardly, but instead just watching. And it's that sense of complete stillness, complete poise, that allows that absolute clarity in seeing the truth, which is what's needed for a deep penetration to the truth. Absolute clarity. And it's like we put our camera on a tripod, it just sits there. Whatever it photographs, it's not going to. If we're holding the camera in our hands, then we can always react to something, that we're looking at something and maybe we can pull back or go towards it, or maybe some movement in the camera. But once it's on a tripod, it just sits there. Whatever it's photographing, it stays exactly still. And that's that stability of equanimity. It just watches whatever is there. And when all of those things are together, and when all of those things have ripened and done their function, leading to awakening, then the awakened mind also has those qualities as well. It has a quality of great memory, great mindfulness, sadasato, the one who's enlightened, the arahant, is always mindful, sadasato. And they have a quality of investigation into dhammas. Whatever kind of dhamma principle is there, then you can hold it in the mind, investigate it, understand it clearly. And it has a quality of great joy, a quality of stillness, tranquility. While the awakened mind has a quality of samadhi. So people who are arahants, for example, can always access into samadhi, and they can always realize fourth jhana. And the arahant, of course, has the complete equanimity, what they call the chalangubekha of the arahant, the complete equanimity to sight, sound, smell, taste, touches, and mental objects. It doesn't mean they don't feel pleasure and pain, but it means that they're equanimous towards those feelings of pleasure and pain. So in this way, the awakening factors are qualities which each of us can see and experience in our minds. And they're qualities which we can develop in our path, and they're qualities which we can recognize in the awakened mind. As qualities which we can experience in ourselves, then it's important to remind ourselves that. And again, this is part of that practice of Dhamma Vichaya. So after we finish the talk for tonight, we go back to our kuti, back to our room, back to our cave or whatever, and you sit down and recollect, oh, mindful of what were those eight factors, was it? Seven? Oh, hang on, it was four of them. Hang on, no, seven. Right, seven factors of darkness. No, seven factors of curry ingredients, no, seven factors of awakening, right, okay. And what was the first one? Something about mindfulness. Yeah. So you recollect them. And then investigate Dhamma Vichaya, okay. And then try to apply that to yourself. Okay, where can I see that in myself? Mindfulness, yeah? And we sometimes have this an over expectation in terms of mindfulness. Like we hear teachings that you should be always mindful, like a complete flow of uninterrupted mindfulness. And we think that we should be able to do everything in the day with complete moment to moment of mindfulness and awareness of everything that we do. And of course, that's a great practice to be able to do that. But the reality is, of course, we can't. But that doesn't mean we're unmindful. You know, that level of mindfulness is something we can only really develop on an intensive retreat. And when we're just meditating most of the day, and we can really develop that. But that doesn't mean we're completely unmindful. If we're completely unmindful, we'd be mad. Yeah? And mindfulness is what holds us together, holds our sense of identity. We remember who we are. We remember what we're doing. We actually have a lot of mindfulness that we're developing through the day. Every day, whether we think about it or not. So we reflect on that. Reflect on the Dhamma Vichaya. Yes, we all have that quality of investigation into Dhammas. We're interested in it. The energy. Yeah, we all have energy for the Dhamma. Yeah, it doesn't mean we don't have any laziness as well, but it means that we can recognize there is a quality that we do actually try. Yeah? And the joy, it's there. We all have experienced that. Remind ourselves that there is that sense of joy, that sense of freshness, that sense of naive devotion to the Dhamma. Is there tranquility? Again, remember that we all have a degree of tranquility. And so it's there. And the equanimity, samadhi, yeah, the coming together of the mind. Maybe we haven't perfected or realized deep meditation yet, and yet we can still recognize that there's a certain sense of collectedness in our mind, and which deepens in meditation. Yeah? So this is. There's samadhi, and then equanimity or bekha. Yeah? They recognize that. And you think of occasions when, you know, there were things which were attractive or repulsive, and which we were able to mediate that with equanimity. Yeah? You presented with some food that you like at the lunchtime, and you know, practice not being greedy with that. Yeah? Or put in some situation which was stressful and you wanted to explode or something, but then you had equanimity, you didn't react forcefully to it, and so on. And so you recognize that there is that sense of equanimity in us. So all of us have these qualities. So this is that Dhamma Vichaya is sati is reminding ourselves what the qualities are. Dhamma Vichaya is investigating them inside us. And as we learn to investigate them and identify them clearly within us, we can actually learn to just bring them up by means of a thought. You can actually evoke them, the mental qualities, just by reminding yourself of them and then bringing that into mind, and then that helps, and that can actually develop the quality itself just by reminding and encouraging yourself to have the quality. So this is a very beautiful practice to do. You can do this just when you come back from the Dhamma talk tonight and sit down and remind yourself of that. And keep on doing that. Do that every day, and you can go through. Just remind yourself of these factors. Oh, okay, I can reflect on them. This kind of reflective practice, or Dhamma Vichaya practice, is something which can complement, you know, the more sort of straight samadhi-based meditation where you're just focusing on a meditation object. These contemplative practices into the investigating the different Dhamma categories and Dhamma concepts and so on. It's helping you to understand the Dhamma and helping you to integrate the external theory of the Dhamma with your own inner experience. So this is my little talk for you this evening on awakening practices. And does anyone have any comments or questions? Okay, so let's finish by saying that.
Bhagavan, Bhagavan.